Hi, thank you everyone for coming. It's 5 p.m. on a Sunday after we lost an hour last night. Well, thanks for staying awake at this time. So this is the three R's of horror: remix, reboots, and rediscoveries. So my name is K.W. Lowe, and I'm a co-founder of Dread Central, a horror entertainment news website. And I would like to introduce you to you our esteemed list of panelists right here. Whoops, the PowerPoint thing works. All right, so very quickly, just who they are and whatnot. So I did some fancy looking PowerPoint animation.
That's right. I'm Adam Green.
Yeah. Well, there we go. We'll start alphabetically.
Nice.
Alphabetically. So Dan Ferenc did a few things. Such as, as you can see out there, so fancy looking thing with, in fact, the final thing, the Amityville horror related stuff that he'll talk about in a little bit. Then next we have Adam Green right here.
Where are you looking?
More fun stuff over there, and Holliston.
No spiral, really, thanks.
Did anyone go to his panel on Holliston earlier?
Yes.
Awesome. No. Awesome.
Thank you.
They found it.
So next important guy to know, if you are a filmmaker, you want this guy to buy your film.
Woo!
Right. So he has bought such films like over there. And yeah, and lovely Molly is premiering at South By, right?
Tomorrow.
What time?
I believe 9:30.
All right, you guys should get in line.
Creepy movie.
And last but not least, here, this is something I kept seeing you tweeting about. Right? Well, he is full of snark. So what I did was I pulled some of his snarkiest reviews from Rotten Tomatoes, see if you can recognize what movies they're referring
Those
to.
Those are all my movies, you dick.
Oh, my God. That's awesome. I love myself.
God. Well, in case you're wondering, first one is kind of obvious, right?
Mm. Oh, God. Am I the only person in the room? Anyone else here see Gone?
No.
There you go.
I did.
Me and you, losers.
The funniest is I thought was the last one, Irish Villages.
Oh yeah, well that's you can give the screenwriters credit for that. That was just me regurgitating the premise for a really cool horror film called Grabbers from Ireland, which is the premise is that monsters are attacking a small village, and they discover, you know, in every monster movie there is of course something that stops the monster: bacteria, cold, fire, hot. Well, it turns out that in this film it's alcohol. So the entire village has to stay drunk in order to keep the monsters away.
That's
and
awesome.
I'm not kidding. It played at Sundance. It's quite clever, and it was just picked up recently by
IFC.
Thank you, Peter Block.
Cool. So next, we're ready to get started on our panel, and this is my shameless plug for Dread Central, playing around the entire time we talk. So first question to everyone here. So why do you think the horror genre is so susceptible to remakes, reboots, and rediscoveries, or the three R's for short?
Because they make money. Because the audience loves remakes. And this is always an unpopular thing. Every convention I do, every time I speak about stuff. Now, I have not done a remake yet. And one of the ways that I was able to make my first film, Hatchet, successful was by using the rejection letter from a major studio as the tagline on the poster. So the poster said, "It's not a remake. It's not a sequel, and it's not based on a Japanese one." And that was the tagline for Hatchet.
I love that it's Japanese one. It's not Japanese film.
But that was the rejection letter.
That's funny.
The actual rejection said, "The writing is brilliant. However, this film will not get made because it's not a remake, it's not a sequel, and it's not based on a Japanese one." So,
if you had submitted it with the title Friday the 13th Part 6 remake, they would have bought it, you think?
They would have totally done it. In fact, recently,
I don't even know how many Friday the 13th there have been anyway. So most of the people who make them, I think the studios are
They've even forgotten how many there are.
But the fans love to complain, oh, now they're remaking this, now they're remaking that. But they're the first ones to get in line to go see them and then complain about them and then buy the DVD and then complain about that. But they don't go see original movies. So a lot of times the originals are condemned to these art house releases. You get a couple screens. And I've been very fortunate that all of my films have gotten a theatrical release, but they're released on like 100 screens. There's no commercials. There's no real advertising. Nobody knows they're there, except for, you know, the horror. I did not do that on purpose, whoever that was that I knocked over. But, you know, we did a festival in Texas called Dallas Fear Fest, and everyone, I said, what do you guys think about remakes? And everyone booed. I'm like, anybody see The Hills Have Eyes 2? And everyone booed. And then I said, how many people here have seen Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon? Not one hand. And it was playing at 4 theaters within 10 miles of that convention center, but nobody went to see it. So that's why we're looking at the studios really only doing remakes and reboots and reimaginings, in my opinion.
I think it speaks to, like, people want something that's slightly new but mostly old. They know they like Friday the 13th. They know they like Halloween. So the idea that we're going to put out a new – Hollywood's going to put out a new one in theory, it should be the best of both worlds, the best of what made the original Halloween good and hopefully something new that the filmmakers bring to it. Unfortunately, Rob Zombie has the directing skills of a fucking mule, so that's just my opinion, but I think his remake of Halloween is shitting on the face of one of the best films ever made, frankly. But I think that they appeal because it is the idea of, wow, in a great situation, we could have half classic and half new, and boy, wouldn't that be fun. And I'm sure most people would agree that if we eliminate all horror remakes, we lose The Fly, we lose The Thing, we lose, you know, Let Me In, which is not superior, but is a damn good film. We lose a lot of good movies. So my problem is not with necessarily remakes or sequels or reboots. My problem is with lazy producers.
Well, from a acquisition guy's point of view, what do you think?
Well, I'm the guy that bought Behind the Mask, Leslie Vernon, so thank you for that. Yeah. But,
and if you haven't seen it, you definitely should, because it is made for anybody who would come to this panel. That's who Behind the Mask was made for.
Because honestly,
wonderful movie.
After, you know, I started at Anchor Bay, so all of, like, you can blame me for all the Evil Deads that you bought, you know, for a while there. But I will say this. And
I have the rubber one.
Exactly. That's, to me, the final one. But to be honest with you, and it would have came out eventually, and it kind of follows with the studios and what Scott was saying. You never would have probably got a Dario Argento movie or Lucio Fulci if I couldn't have released Evil Deads, because I know those were the money makers. And the powers that be who give me the money to go buy these movies, they're like, what the fuck is the New York Ripper, you know, or something, you know, or like Dario Argento, like what is happening in this movie?
Who says that?
Well, the financier, you know, and so I'm like, look, let us just trust us. We're going to build this brand, but we got to release another Evil Dead or another Halloween. And so, while I agree, like, it is a money grab in a way.
It's a give and take.
But honestly, without that, you would not have saw us. And with Anchor Bay, at that time, we built up to a point that I could buy. Because let's face it, all the catalog was used up. So what? Either we were going to sink or swim. So luckily, we bought a Hatchet. We bought Behind the Mask. And really kind of grew to where Anchor Bay kind of is now. And, you know, I'm no longer there. But, you know, from there, I've gone to Image. So I look at it at this way. For me, back in the day, I loved when people did remakes because I had the originals, the original Dawn of the Dead, the original Halloweens, the Hills Have Eyes. Well, Hellraiser, I guess, never got remade, but I was waiting for that for 18 years. Yeah, to it. So for me, I loved it, you know, as for us, because it was great to show people the original, because, you know, like I said, I always say the original is always there. So
I have a question for you, Mark, as a man who works for distribution companies. A lot of times the defenders of remakes, in which I am one often, not always, but will say, well, if the worst thing that the Dawn of the Dead remake does is bring some new young people to Dawn of the Dead original, that's a pretty good thing. As a guy who, you know, sells DVDs, would you agree that that's the case? When Dawn comes out, does the old Dawn sell well?
We sold, I would say, almost a million units. And let's say the year before, because Dawn's a, we call them evergreens, like Halloween, Evil Dead, Dawn of the Dead.
They'll always sell.
Children of the Corn will sell every year.
Gotcha.
But the uptick. Exactly, exactly. But the uptick from when that came out, it blew everyone away.
Right.
And just
so it's good for the industry in a whole.
It is. It is. So, and it made people excited and all that. And same thing kind of not as much as with Halloween or Hills Have Eyes and Halloween, but absolutely it is true that they say it's like, well, the worst thing that can happen is they go by the original. I can attest to it. That is true that they went and saw the original.
But we're all wrong because the worst case scenario is the Fog remake. That's the word. That's the word.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, in addition to remake, we have rediscoveries, which I define as not just remake, but documentary style, et cetera, things like that. And we have one of the kings of rediscovery here, Dan, with all his works. In, well, his name was Jason, Never Sleep Again, and the upcoming Amityville.
He's what we call in the biz a horror curator, and he's one of the best at it. Anytime Dan puts out something for a horror series as a documentary, I immediately want to get it.
Thank you guys for appreciate it.
I can say I think if you guys haven't seen Never Sleep Again, I think it's the best documentary about any film ever. I mean, it's that well done.
Thank you guys. I mean, and just to talk about Never Sleep Again for a minute, I mean, we were huge fans of Nightmare on Elm Street. We knew that this reboot was coming up, this, you know, reinvention of the original movie, and we were like out there going, nobody, we knew it was going to be a disaster. We knew it was going to be terrible. We wanted to sort of be those guys. We wanted to be, the day that that was released, we wanted this documentary to be available for the true fans of the original series. And it's kind of like our antidote to the remake.
And how did you feel when you saw it and it was great?
Well, thank you for that, but nobody wanted it. Like,
really?
New Line didn't want it. Warner Brothers didn't want it. I love Anchor Bay, but they didn't want it.
Who did put it out?
So, you know, we ended up doing it completely on our own. We self-financed it. We self-distributed it. Every phase of it, we did it as fans for fans, and we didn't want to compromise on it. And I think, you know, when the 2-hour documentary became a 3-hour documentary, we're like, okay, let's just do it. And then when the 3-hour became a 4-hour, people were looking at us like, even we were pushing the limit of what a DVD could hold content wise. But we're like, well, let's just max it out and do like the definitive full story. And I think it's something I think fans really embrace. I think more of that stuff has got to be done.
In order for a documentary to be put next to Friday the 13th on my shelf, it has to be respectful and complimentary those two at very least definitely do. Never Sleep Again has a spot on my shelf.
Thank you very much.
And to take that one step further, you know, you could watch something on Netflix or watch it on cable, but half the reason, unless you're just a fanatic collector like myself, that you do actually buy the Blu-ray or the DVD is that bonus content that comes with it. It's those special features, the making of, the commentaries. And unfortunately, a lot of distributors don't care that much about it anymore. I found myself with several titles having to do all of that myself and just hand it to them. If it's free, fine, they'll take it and they'll put it on if you give it to them in time. A lot of times they're just like, it doesn't matter. We don't need it. And that's unfortunate because a lot of times if it's a movie that you love, that stuff is almost just as important as the movie.
Yeah, we had a great, I mean, Adam was involved. His name was Jason for Mark and for Anchor Bay. But right after that, Paramount reached out to me and they said, hey, we heard you're involved in some Friday the 13th project and we'd like to use your services. We want to reissue the DVDs, but we're getting a lot of complaints that we're not giving the fans what they really want to see. So I was fortunate to be able to dig into those archives of Paramount and dig up all of those.
So what new? I was curious about that myself because I bought the first set with all the slipcases.
Yep.
And then I got the Blu-rays. So what is now on Paramount's most recent reissue that you contributed?
Well, you know, I didn't come in until 4.
Okay.
The final chapter, and then we did 4 through 8. The slipcover version, the deluxe editions, and those are the ones I think. If you look at those and that first reissue, there's the more on the 4 through 8 than 1 through 3.
Yes.
I wasn't involved in those, and they knew they were kind of heading down the wrong road. Like the reviews were bad on the first three. So I said, look, you know, there's an
Steve Miner participating might have helped.
Yeah, that would help, but he just doesn't want to do it.
I don't get
Steve
it.
Steve is just kind of over it. I don't know. Sometimes a director moves on in his career and he just doesn't.
Oh, I respect that, but he's directing sitcoms now. Come on.
I agree. There might be a chance. I mean, we're actually talking about revisiting again one more time, and not for the sake of the triple dip, but the whole series has not been released on Blu-ray yet, and I'm hoping that we can get Paramount within the next year, maybe for 2013 would be.
Ask him to wedge it into all the first eight into one long movie.
Yeah. And then we also have other content as well we can add and other interviews and people that we actually haven't been able to feature as much. So we're going to – and speaking of which, we actually just did – there was a book that I was involved with you guys might have seen called Crystal Lake Memories, which Amazing. Was a fantastic book. Peter Bracke wrote it.
But
there was another thing that we did completely on our own, like Paramount didn't believe in it at the time. And I think it was really the first one in that wave of like – sort of discovered.
Who was the author of that? He used to
Peter
run
Bracke.
Yeah. Peter Bracke.
Peter
Bracke. Great writer.
Yeah,
really good writer.
He is a great writer.
How does it work, though, with Paramount and New Line working together to get that box set out? Because that's been the problem with the Halloween franchise and why we don't have it, because it's too spread out.
It is. It's going to be, there will have to be some compromise made at some point, or not, or we just do the Paramount box set and the New Line might have their own, which is never ideal.
Yeah, how could we live without the deluxe edition of Jason Goes to Fucking Hell? I mean, Jason in the Hidden, I should say.
Yeah.
But I think there's a whole new world to be mined. And I think, look, we've seen a lot of Blu-rays and a lot of special features and bonus features on discs. But I think there's actually a lot more. I think with Never Sleep Again, we kind of tapped into something much bigger. And I think we can go for longer content on these. I think we proved that people will sit through a four-hour documentary if it's good. And if you're telling people stories they haven't heard before.
And it works really well. For example, if I'm at a film festival and they say, oh, there's a documentary about Nightmare on Elm Street, I want to see it. It's going to be 2 hours because that's how things work when you play exhibit movies in a theater.
Right.
When you're making something distinctly for the home video market, for the hardcore fans, what's it matter if it's 4 hours?
That's
they can pause
we just,
it and come back tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah?
We didn't want to compromise on that level, and we thought, well, let's treat each movie with the same kind of respect you might have for the first one.
Right, not 90%
part
one.
There are fans out there of, Freddy's Dead. Not many.
Yeah, in addition to the 4 hours, wasn't there another 4 hours of commentary?
There's commentary on the latest edition, and then also there's a 4 hour bonus disc on top of all of that. So it's a pretty full package. But we did it standalone, and I think that's what is kind of cool about it is that we figured out a way to do it and keep our overhead really low and still deliver what I think fans wanted to see. I mean, people think that it's full of clips, and if you look at that show closely, it's really not.
What would be your holy grail of lost footage? Like five, maybe? Part five?
Five. He was just saying that on the way up here.
We know.
Five
we know.
And
seven, maybe? There's got to be
seven. Unfortunately, I know. This is something, that we literally almost lost it. We found out when I was working on part seven, the reissue of part seven, we found a box, an empty box with an order from some executive in Paramount who shall remain nameless in 1991 or two, who ordered all of that footage destroyed. So all of the outtakes for Friday 7 were
Was it
were
Frank
destroyed.
Mancuso?
No, it wasn't. Okay. He would never do that.
All right, bringing back to the 3 R's. I know one of you guys mentioned something about the 3 R's kind of being acting like a gateway drugs for younger viewers. I mean, is that still true? But then given that the state of what those new 3 R's are, kind of turning away the older viewers, the older fans.
Well, you'll always have the original. And, of course, when I saw John Carpenter's The Thing, that's what made me go back to The Thing from Another Planet. And see, I'm sure at this point, being a complete and total loser, or geek or whatever I am.
Not complete.
But I would have found it eventually. But it is true. It does make you look back for the original. What's weird, though, is... I grew up on John Carpenter's Halloween. So when I'm doing a convention appearance or an autograph signing and these younger kids are like 14, 15 come through, they don't know that one. They know Rob Zombie's Halloween and they love it. And then you're like, well, did you ever see the original? They're like, well, it was on TV. It's just so boring. And then you have to try to not jump over the desk and like strangle them. What are you, stupid? But I mean, that's the age they're at and that's what they know. So... on the positive note, whether you like some of these remakes or not, what what I'm enjoying about them is that Michael Myers and Leatherface and Jason, they've become the new Wolfman and Dracula and Frankenstein, and that's pretty cool to see. Like, it's like at 100 years from now, they are still going to be known because they become that iconic.
Because your next film is Frankenstein versus Freddy.
Of course. But well, who's to say that couldn't happen at some point?
Right.
But there's not... They don't really make... They stopped making horror movies like that. That was one of the things that people gravitated to Hatchet for, was because there was a villain again in Victor Crowley. And so does that make him an icon yet? No. Like, you know, you got to wait 20 years to see. But it is cool to see that happen and see these villains become household names.
Well, I think, you know, back in... To what I would like to see with what's happening, because let's face it, there you really can't. What else out there is really to remake of the classics? What there's their Phantasm,
the Boogans.
Yeah, right, I mean, but you know what I mean, like the big when you see like Nightmare on Elm Street. I can't believe they're doing that. Like, what is there really left,
dude? Once they hit Sorority Row, you're like, what? Really?
Now what happens? I had a pitch at one of the companies that will remain nameless, but that is notorious for doing remakes, so you can figure it out. And I was like, what? They've been trying for years to figure out a movie to do with me. Then I've passed on the various remakes because I'd rather do my own original stuff. And I said, why don't we do an original movie? And they were like, we're open to that. What's your pitch? So I pitched them this movie. And when it was done, they said, that's great. We'll call it Rosemary's Baby. And it had nothing. There wasn't a baby in it. Like, there was nothing to do with Rosemary's Baby. And they said, doesn't matter. If you call it Rosemary's Baby, which we own the title to, it will open at $32 million.
Well, now we know what company it was.
Yep. And I said, but I will be destroyed. Like, everyone will crucify me for that. And I'll be the guy that fucked up Rosemary's Baby. And they're like, $32 million, Adam.
Yeah.
And the problem is, like, I happen to have probably too much integrity, but like, there's somebody out there that was just so desperate for a job, they'd be like, I'd do it.
Well, didn't
I'll do it?
Didn't you? Exactly. Then you get pitched like American Werewolf in London. Like, what about those werewolves?
Yes,
you know, lose those.
American Werewolf in London. At one point, they came to me for that, and they're like, here's the deal, though, we don't really want werewolves in it. We're like, we're just, you know, the whole like hair and teeth, everyone's over it. So we want it to be hot chicks. And
American beatnik.
We don't know really what happens, but they just turn into a rage. You know, they just get really super sexy. And we don't want it to be funny. We don't want it to be funny because in John Landis's movie, the comedy didn't work. And that's when I left that meeting.
See, how could you live there?
The other meeting I walked out of, a company that was in, I don't know if you guys saw my movie Frozen. Thank you. There was a... one of the companies I met with, there were four different places that were really interested in making it. And one of them, I walk in there and the guy says, all right, page turn, and starts a page turn of my script. Not even a, hi, how are you? What's your vision for this? Just starts going through it. And he's like, you need to introduce the wolves by page 5. I'm like, but the wolves, it's kind of a surprise later. He's like, it's a film about wolves. We need the wolves by page 5. Then he said, what's a Sarlacc pit? I said, it's from Return of the Jedi. What is that? So, Star Wars? Never saw it. I'm like, fuck you.
Speaking of, here's a good example of how remakes happen most of the time in Hollywood. Sometimes, of course, you have somebody who has a producer normally has a vision to honor the original and come up with something new, which is what they did with Dawn of the Dead, for example, and to a degree other remakes. How long, without naming any names, how long has the Motel Hell remake been bouncing around Hollywood?
Well, let's start with Joe Lynch.
Yeah.
How long has that been bouncing around?
Like,
no comment.
Yeah. Yeah. Motel Hell. It's like they own a name. It's like the people in the meeting with you haven't even seen it.
Yeah.
They just own the name, and they know that a certain contingent of horror fans want to see Motel Hell and recognize the name. Name recognition sells tickets. It just does. Good, bad, or indifferent. It does.
It's the same thing as advertising. It's how many impressions, how many times you saw the commercial. Eventually, it's in your head, and you will see it. So if you can take a title like Motel Hell that's recognizable, now you've already got one leg up. So, and the thing is, it's like, for me personally, I'm not against remakes at all. Like, I love some of them. I think they're great. Like what Mark was saying before, like, they're not always necessarily bad. What's sad, though, is on the studio level, there's so far less original movies now getting made, and you can't do anything about it because they don't perform as well. Every now and then there's one that breaks out. But
we could be looking at this with rose-colored glasses, though, because, I mean, when we were young...
We're old.
When we were young guys, we were running out to see Friday 2, Friday 3, exactly. Friday 4, and guys our age were like, you got to be kidding me. Like, right. Okay, once or twice is one thing, but... Is this all the kids want? Is knives and slashing? That's
yes.
all that.
Yes.
Well, that would have been a legitimate complaint back then that sequels have inundated the marketplace, right. just like
I think now. Yeah, it was sequels back then as opposed to remakes now.
Sequels are fine.
No, but kids these days. I mean, I think let's face it.
Sequels and remakes are the same thing.
Freddy,
aren't they?
For Freddy and Us is now it's a you know it's Paranormal Activity is the new Friday 13th for 13-year-olds. You know, or high schoolers. They will be there. Every weekend for the foreseeable future.
Why can't y'all lower yourself and make it more paranormal?
I got one of those in the works.
Well, no. Like for me, for instance, I do a lot of studio writing and stuff, but all the movies I've made are independent movies, and so I haven't had to do that. I think Paranormal Activity was a terrific movie. Like the first one was excellent, and everybody thought they'd never make another Blair Witch, and then somebody did, and they did a great job. So there are ways to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Paranormal Activity, like Blair Witch, was. Paranormal Activity actually came through Anchor Bay. Well,
okay, sir, that's a great as far question. As that question goes, Paranormal Activity premiered at Slam Dance.
Yep.
Some people saw it, like me. We went nuts for it. And 8 months later, I think it was 6 months later, Paramount bought it. So
Paramount bought it to remake it with like me as Joe.
Correct.
Bush.
Correct.
And the reason, because I honestly thought I was going to get it, but thank God it didn't come to Anchor Bay, because to be honest, there would be no Paranormal Activity too. It would have been on, you know, small theaters. It never would have worked, because we wouldn't have put in, you know, the $5 to $10 million that Paramount did put in. They don't like to say that, but they put in a lot of money to make that movie work. But what happened was, they literally were going to buy it to remake it with a name, or S name, and they were going to do a TV show, because at the time, like, Ghost Hunters was very popular, And I'm like, that's a great deal for Oren. I mean, because he's a genuinely great guy. And the rumor is Spielberg saw it and brought it back in a bag and said, never let me see this again, but release it on 2,000 screens. You know, so I don't know if that happened, but they genuinely, but to their credit, there are people out there at a studio level that recognize that movie itself could work. And
then what, this year Paramount tried the exact same hook with Devil Inside, and we saw how that worked out.
But it worked.
It did work.
Yeah. Solid Fs from all the critics. Every audience hated it. And how much did it end up making?
Maybe?
$50 million.
I think it opened
dollars.
To 25.
And they were polling people leaving. Why did you go see it? Well, I heard it sucks so bad I wanted to see it.
Well, I mean.
Sweet, thanks. Yeah, but it's easier said than done to say, like, so why don't you just make something like a Paranormal Activity, lower the budgets, and just keep making things like that. And we are seeing that happen because
That's the new model now, it seems like.
It is, because the financing, DVDs are like, for sales, are like down 40% across the board, because a lot of that problem is from the BitTorrenting. This is another unpopular subject that comes up. People who are stealing the movies hate it when you talk about the fact that they're stealing the movies. And they're very entitled to it, and they get very angry if you say stop. But that is a problem. And hopefully, over the next few years, we're going to figure out a way to start utilizing the internet and utilizing this technology to have everything work together at the same time to stop it. Because a lot of the reasons why people are stealing the movies is because there's no other way for them to get them. You hear about a Serbian film, and you hear all these reviews, but there's no way to see it, so you resort to a BitTorrent site, and you steal it.
Come over to my house.
But a lot of these filmmakers, they might make a great movie. You don't get to make another movie unless you can prove that movie turned a profit, and they don't care about.
Oh, Adam, I tell you, whenever we talk about movie piracy on Twitter, I'm on Twitter, by the way. Whenever we bring it up, it is amazing. You would think I'm just like stuffing the ballot box to make my point. I get 6 or 7 responses that says, oh, it's not the same as Shoplifters. It's not the same as Shoplifters.
When Frozen opened, we were on 100 screens. We had no marketing and really no awareness. And every dollar counted so much to see if that movie was going to get the chance to be expanded.
How is a producer supposed to know if his movies did well? The only way a producer can know is by looking at ticket sales, money brought in, the cinema score, the reviews. And if you have a film stolen by 25,000, 30,000 people...
Wait, it goes worse. So... Frozen, the weekend it opened on 100 screens, was BitTorrented 200,000 times. And so I'm on Twitter saying, please, guys, like, this is an independent movie. Like stop stealing my movie. And the venom that I got back from my fans.
How dare you, Adam?
Wait, no. The first one was, fuck you, you greedy Jew. Don't you have enough money?
That was from me.
Yeah. The second one was, I pay $60 a month for high-speed internet. You owe me this. And then the third one was, we only steal your movies because we like them. You should be thanking us. And so New York Magazine reached out to me and said, you know, we're watching this happen, and we want to do a story on this. And at this point, I'm terrified because I'm now the Lars Ulrich of horror. And and they said, we want to put a real filmmaker, a real person behind what people think is a victimless crime. And so we do this interview, hour-long interview, all about how the financing is put together for these movies, how important it is that people pay to see them and all this stuff. And then at the very end of the interview, the guy says, so why do you think Frozen bombed? And I said, what? How do you figure that? How do you figure it bombed? It was on 100 screens. It actually did very well. He's like, yeah, but why were there no commercials? Why were there no billboards? I didn't see anything for it. I'm like, well, look, that's Anchor Bay's model. It's what they do. Anyway, by the time he puts the story out, all it is Adam Green shits on Anchor Bay, and like, they didn't do enough, and they don't do this, and that's like, oh my God. Like, it was awful. So now I don't even want to talk to like the journalists about it anymore, but I'm so scared to talk about BitTorrenting, and it sucks because fans will tweet me directly, hey, I just downloaded Hatchet 2 and watched it illegally. I fucking
see it
loved
all the
it.
Time. Hey, yeah. Man, just watched your movie, and I'm thinking, that guy's movie doesn't come out for 2 weeks on video. Right. I know this.
And you can't say anything back.
Right. We had the same thing, I have to say, with Never Sleep Again, which was completely fan-made with our own money. Anything we made was went right back to just paying for that show. And frankly, the same thing happened within 24 hours of the release of that. It was on every BitTorrent site. And we were doing everything we could.
If you folks have any questions, yeah. Raise your hands so someone, one volunteer, will bring a mic to you. Well, we'll do the Q&A right now.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I know we're not really doing Q&A. I don't like started, but it kind of goes along with this. Like, how does it work with Netflix? Because everything seems to be pushing to go towards Netflix. And like when Chillerama came on, I was like,
but the thing is, Netflix paid for that. Netflix, that's all accounted for. It's like when people say, well, if I bought your movie and I show it to a friend at my house, am I stealing it? No, like that's all accounted. They know that that's going to happen. And like Netflix paid a lot of money for Chillerama, and so that's all accounted for. It's when somebody gets, however they got it, a digital copy, and then puts it up, and millions of people start stealing it, right. You can't recover from that, and it's gone. A lot of times, it's not even the finished version of the movie that people get their hands on.
Tell them that trick we tried to do, Adam.
It was successful. For Hatchet 2, we made a version of the movie that it had the first 5 minutes, and then it was my cat's litter box. And then there was one, what else did we do? It was like Ozzie and Harriet.
Mm-hmm. You just recorded sitcoms?
Sitcoms. And it worked for a while because people got so frustrated because you spend 6 hours downloading
across the torrent sites, and it's a big enough file so it actually looks like a movie. It doesn't look like a fake name. And then people download it, and it's like a really nasty killer, some boobs, and then his cat pooping for an hour.
Yeah, and so then they... They download the next one, and eventually it got so confusing, and then I got hate mail. I've been trying to download your fucking movie, and all it is your cat.
Right, now again, his job is to write and maybe direct a film. Why should he have to spend months putting, like, fake files on a torrent site? Like, William Castle didn't have to do that. Like, other filmmakers didn't have to do that. It's not fair. I'm not a filmmaker, and I probably never will be one, but anybody who respects films and filmmakers should not fucking steal them.
I had this debate with Lloyd Kaufman. Lloyd Kaufman from Troma at Comic-Con last summer, where Lloyd was saying he is very much for the BitTorrenting and the sharing because that's how a lot of people see these movies. But I had to remind Lloyd that when The Toxic Avenger came out, it had everybody stolen it, there would be no Troma. There would be no Toxic Avenger 2. None of that would have happened.
And I would have said, Lloyd, your films are worth about nothing. So
oh, come on.
Okay, so just kidding.
So everyone remember, don't BitTorrent. So, but anyway, we should get back into some remake discussion kind of thing.
Can I ask my question?
I know you guys have been ragging on lots of titles.
Okay. Question, though.
Oh, did I miss a question?
Hi.
All right, one question.
All right, thanks.
Stand up.
I don't mean, you didn't make him stand up. Why? Why do I have to stand up?
I just want to see you stand up. Now everybody knows why.
Excuse the ignorance of my question. I never have pirated, never would dream of it. I am lucky enough to know where Scott lives in case I need to see something I can't get my hands on. But it was curious when you said that you know how many times the movie was downloaded. I'm wondering why the industry doesn't look at that and say, oh, well, that means it was good.
So, well, sometimes they do. In the case of Wrong Turn 2, who Joe, the director, is sitting in here today, they did... Fox did point to that at one point and say, okay, that's good. But I've tried that with other stuff where I'm like, all right, so yeah, this is what it did in theaters when you didn't advertise it, but look at these hundreds of thousands of downloads, but they didn't get any money out of that, so that doesn't help them recoup.
I hope to write a book one day, something about horror. You know, all legitimate film critics have to write a book before they're respected, and I want respect. So I want to write a book one day, if I can think of a hook, okay? But now, what... My book's about to come out in 6 days, all right? I can't wait for every horror geek and every friend in the world I know to read it. I am really just proud of myself because I stuck with it and I finished a book and found a publisher and made money and I'm baked and I'm happy, right? And then I find out, oh, Scott, that book that all the horror geeks are raving about is now up on a torrent site and people can download it and read it in an hour. Like... That's literally what happens to these guys. These are not fat cat people who just sit around going, oh, it's who cares? I still got my $6 million. It ruins careers. It really does. I mean...
Sure. You know, maybe next year I'll have a panel about torrenting and piracy and invention yeah. back on.
Just, it's a hot button and it just...
I have a new TV show coming out if we want to talk about that.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to your TV show in a little bit.
Yes.
All right, we have a treat from Holliston in a little bit. So if nice. We get through with this, we'll get to it. So can we hold off our questions until in a little while? Thanks. So, you know, as I was getting back to all the three R's, you guys were so ragging on all those titles. Has there been a good remake?
Oh, hell yeah. There's been a lot of good remakes, I think. Well, I mean, going back, I mean...
The Toolbox Murders, baby.
The Thing was great. I love the remake of Texas Chainsaw. I know that's an unpopular thing to say for some people, but...
I like it. I don't love it, but I like it. I do.
I like Dawn of the Dead. I like... I mean, there are plenty of good remakes out there.
Toolbox Murders. I always throw that one out there, and I'm not joking. The original is sleazy and really dull. The remake is quite entertaining. You know what I mean? It's not, you know, on the same level as The Fly or The Thing, but...
Oh, The Fly. I mean, Jesus. That's
Invasion
like...
of the Body Snatchers. I mean, come
yeah,
on.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
But then we get into the horror remake that's coming out.
We get into the big nerd topic of, are the other versions of Body Snatchers, are they film remakes or are they adaptations of Jack Finney? Which are they?
Holliston, April 3rd.
What do you, Mark? As a distributor, what do you think of, like, you got an offer for a remake that you know is a piece of crap, and the horror fans are gonna...
I spit on your grave. Were you still there?
No, I wasn't there.
All right, good example.
For example, you know, I might have seen it or might not have after the fact, but that title did phenomenal for them, and I think it had everything to do with the box art and the title itself, because...
It's the only reason. It's the title's why it was made.
And so it shows, it, I guess, and that's not a remake that, you know, went on 2,000 screens. That's almost, I don't want to say it was a direct-to-video remake, but...
It got a cursory theatrical.
It was close enough to be out there. So it shows you, with success of that, it's the title... And they were.
Can you imagine, like, growing up? We all knew that I Spit on Your Grave was like this infamous, nasty, nasty movie. And someone said, "Oh yeah, they're gonna remake it in 2011."
Exactly.
I'd be like, "Remake that?
Yeah, exactly.
What? No, they'll remake anything."
Well, I mean, with all this, what about if do you have a movie title or something where you would like to remake if you have the chance of being forced to?
Well, can I start? I just want to say, what I would do. Is if they're going to keep doing, you know, the Freddy's, Jason's, Michael Myers, you know, like comics, you know, like there's the Ultimates versions, like, which is another thing that can go on, and if a character dies, he doesn't die in the main linear comic, why not, almost like a Bond movie, you go get Joe Lynch to go do whatever you want.
Why is it Joe Lynch? I'm sitting right here.
I'll get to you, Adam.
He's not even...
Well, Adam, you should have done remakes before. If so, nobody would tore at your movie to be on 2,000 screens. So, that, you know, the more the story is... No, just kidding. I would do... Like, seriously, give some young filmmaker to come and say, look, you have Michael Myers, you have... $5-10 million, do whatever you want, because let's face it, it's going to still, people are going to go see that movie.
They are getting there, though. Like, some of the more recent ones that I've been talking to them about, they're starting to become open to the idea of taking just the mythology and the character and just doing a new
Prom Night remake. Good.
But they are starting to become open to that, where it's not trying to remake the original story or original characters or even having to stick. Because the problem with a lot of those slasher franchises is they've become so convoluted and gotten so crazy and off course that there almost is no way to still have them all make sense. But you can always go back to the mythology of, like, let's just...
Michael Myers. To kill,
like,
you.
The boogeyman.
Well, it's like you guys said about the Elm Street remake. You know, there's two ways it could suck. The way it does suck is that it just copies the best stuff of the original with no unique ideas or original angles of its own. That's one way to suck. The other way to suck is go way out of left field and make your own movie. I'd much rather the second. You know, I'd much rather watch the latter than their carbon copy remake of Wes Craven's movie.
The remake that I'm trying to do, and I'm actually, this probably going to sound like I'm kidding because this is a horror panel, but I'm not, is Pete's Dragon. I don't know if anybody remembers the Disney movie. But now, especially with the technology and everything, I mean, that story is so timeless. It's so wonderful, and I would love to do it. But even, like, the first few rounds of meetings at Disney, they didn't know what it was. So that's the first hurdle. I would totally do a remake of something like that. Even, like, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon, they've been trying to get that going for so long. And now the problem is they've invested so many millions of dollars in rewrites and writers that the project is already so expensive that it might not ever get made, which is unfortunate because Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is probably my favorite, well, no, Frankenstein and then Creature from the Black Lagoon from the Universal Monsters, it's time to do something like that. I mean, when you're going to the well of Nightmare on Elm Street or a movie that happened like 5 years ago, it's like, come on. But Creature from the Black Lagoon, that's, you could do it in a different way now.
Yeah, if I could remake any horror film, it would be something that they got wrong the first time, in my opinion. I know that's a facile thing to say, but it's really, you know, even if I was a really brilliant filmmaker, I wouldn't want to remake something that I love that much. So my choice would be a 1980 horror film called Death Ship, starring George Kennedy. I would like to... I'm not kidding. I would like to... That is one freaky fucking movie, and it's creepy, and I would like... I mean, it's not entirely successful. I think it could be done better.
Great. What about you, Dan?
Well, I have to throw my hat in the ring because we're doing a new take on Amityville Horror, but not the Michael Bay Platinum Dunes. We're kind of erasing all of that and kind of restart from there. And what I like about this take is that it's sort of taking this concept of found footage, but migrating that to a totally different time period before that was a term that was even known. So it's
Dan,
found footage,
but
it's the home movies that were shot in the house when the event actually occurred. So it's set in the 1970s. It's
get James
really
Brolin to return?
No. And ignoring that, I mean, we actually even refer to the fact that there were books and movies.
Nice. Now, let me ask you this. I've been curious about this, and you would obviously know. Is the name Amityville copyrighted by MGM? Or
it is. It's a complicated... You know, in fact, the attorneys... We're working with Dimension Films on this, but the attorneys who were involved in this actually would call me on an almost weekly basis when we were putting the deal together, and they said, literally, the last deal that this one particular business affairs guy did over at Sony was Spider-Man, and he said the rights for Amityville were more complex than that.
Wow.
So it was...
Interesting.
Yeah, they've got binders about as long as this table dealing with all those rights, but... but it's all in house now, and but I think what's going to be cool about this is it has a new spin on found footage, but also I think it's taking Amityville Horror back to where it should be, which was the original book.
Nice,
great. So with that, we have a video clip premiere for Holliston. It may not be a premiere anymore since it was shown.
No, this is actually what you're going to see has never been seen before.
Holliston is Fearnet's first foray into hardcore porn.
Yes. So speaking of, like, reimaginings, I have a new show coming out starts on April 3rd on the Fearnet cable channel. It's called Holliston. It's a sitcom. It's like regular sitcom, like Friends or Seinfeld, the stage, laugh track, audience, whole thing. It's a show about two guys who are aspiring horror filmmakers, played by myself and Joe Lynch.
The less we know about it, the better.
Nope. And so, absolutely not. And so it premieres on April 3rd. What you're about to see, it's a quick sizzle reel, like a little sample of the show, and then it's a scene from one of the episodes. You'll see myself and Joe are the two main characters. characters, and the blonde girl is Corey, my ex-girlfriend, and the adorable little brunette Laura is Joe's girlfriend on the show. It's probably all you need to know for that specific clip, but it's hard to see a clip from a sitcom without knowing anything about it yet. So here we go. Here's a look at Halston, my reimagining of a sitcom.
So can I play it now?
Yes.
Let's watch King's Speech.
Make it loud. See, it's not even sound.
Uh-oh.
Go back.
And tons of other awesome stop moments. It.
Can we get the volume louder?
There we go. Should be good.
Again. Oops. You know?
That might be
that's not it.
Wrong one. That's the wrong. That's the go. Second clip you're going to watch after this.
Warning. The following program contains violence, sexual content, graphic decapitation, and tons of other awesome moments. Adam and Joe. Mr. Landis, we made it. They're the experts on horror movies. We'll see you next week on
The Movie Crypt.
Nice show, dudes.
Thanks, boss.
But Clueless.
You're my imaginary friend. You can't just leave me when I'm like this.
Get a hookah.
About everything else.
Why would we need your face when we already have your boobs?
This April.
You always say it's not going to hurt, and then I can't poop right for days.
It's funny. When someone loses their head.
Dude, are you scanning me?
Holliston premieres April 3rd, Tuesdays at 10:30 p.m., 7:30 Pacific.
Good evening, Holliston!
Only on FearNet.
Looks like something that fell off my dick in the war.
Slither, drink.
Nice.
Oh, okay. A naked man stole my blue.
An American werewolf in London. Drink. Okay. If you hit the wrong notes, we'll all be flat.
Goody!
Nice.
Excellent. Yeah.
Go, 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 go.
If you hit the wrong note, we'll all be flat.
I just said that.
We didn't get a lot of movies in Columbia.
And that's game. You're popular tonight, Laura.
45 more followers in the past 15 minutes. This is crazy.
Wait, I didn't even know you joined Twitter.
I signed up last night.
It's a great way to promote your artwork. Mm-hmm. Joe and I made an account for Shimpads last year, and we already have, like, what, 60 followers?
12.
What's...
I already have 6,000.
What? How?
Oh, my God. Joe, is that tweet NVI detect?
No. It's just, how does someone get that many followers that fast?
People must like my artwork. I have fans. Yay!
Let me see that.
You guys should be happy for Laura. She could start selling a lot of paintings with this kind of exposure.
Exposure is one word for it.
What do you mean?
Nice profile pic, Laura.
Thanks.
Laura.
What? Look, give me that. What? That's a really cute profile picture.
Thank you.
Scroll down.
What?
Your wugget is showing.
My what?
You have zebra loaf.
You can see the bald man in the boat.
You're displaying a package of pink Thin Mints.
What are you guys talking about?
Meat curtains, ham wallet, Lars Ulrich's knees, Harry Potter, E.T.'s feet.
Okay, honey, you have camel toe in this picture.
Holliston, a FearNet original series, premieres April 3rd.
I could write those jokes. What the fuck?
All right, one more clip. This is a premiere. It was literally downloaded to me an hour ago while I was sitting up here. So here we go.
Hopefully this is very rude.
And in fact, if you want to introduce?
This is the very first showing of the sizzle trailer for Amityville Horror, The Lost Tapes.
All right.
First.
Run
Ronald DeFeo murdered six members of his family in their lovely house in Amityville, Long Island.
The six members of the family were found in bed, shot, and killed.
DeFeo claims he heard voices coming from within the house telling him to murder his family.
We heard the voices.
House made infamous by the book and movie The Amityville Horror was recently sold for the first time in more than three decades. Earlier today, a construction crew that was renovating the house made a gruesome discovery. Police also uncovered film reels and videotapes reportedly shot by a student documentary crew over 30 years ago.
Okay, are you rolling? You good? It's February 25th. 1976. We're the first ones to enter the house since the Lutz family fled. The house, they say, is haunted. We plan to spend the night here, find out if their story is true.
So when are the ghosts gonna show up?
No signs of life. They left all the kids' toys. There's something here. Hello?
No!
Nice.
All right, one last thing. Actually, two last things. We have some swag from Fearnet, courtesy of Fearnet and Holliston. So I'm going to ask Adam to ask you a obscure question. If you can answer his question, you get this swag bag.
Sweet. Okay. For the Hatchet fans, what holiday did Victor Crowley die on?
Eat a bag of dicks.
Don't yell it out.
Well,
all right, you already yelled it out. Halloween is the answer. That's correct. You get these wonderful bag from Fearnet.
All right. Next.
If I could throw in a plug for Fearnet, I write movie reviews there, and I've reviewed, like, Sinister and Wreck 3, Cabin in the Woods, Regression Scale. That's all.
Great. Next is this set of five DVDs. I've asked Dan to ask a question so he can pick the winner.
I gotta come up with one, right?
Yeah.
Why don't you do like.
What holiday did Victor Crowley do?
What was Jason Voorhees' father's name?
Good question.
Ooh.
Joe Lynch? Anyone?
Anybody? Did I stump this entire
room? No, well, you stump everyone.
No. All right, maybe. Bruce?
An easier question, maybe?
What was Jason Voorhees' last name?
Okay, what was his mother's name? Who said it? She did, right?
All right. There you go.
Nice.
All right, now...
And to answer the question, it's Elias Voorhees.
And which film do we find that out in, Dan?
You actually wouldn't have found out unless they actually shot the original ending to Part 6, which they never did, but...
I actually made it up.
We created it for the disc, and also it's in the novelization.
There you go.
Great. So, and are we open for Q&A? Make sure you wave to one of the volunteers to get a mic.
Hi.
Hi.
I have. You were talking about how hard it is when you're pitching a remake, but what about when a director, filmmaker, gets the chance to take a movie in a long franchise and just like. Do something we've never seen in that franchise, kind of like Dream Warriors, Halloween 3, Wrong Turn 2, things like that. You know, when somebody
are we talking about good movies or Wrong Turn?
Well, right. Turn he had two? Me up until
I saw that movie at 11 in the morning. I had a hangover, and after coffee and watching that movie, it was gone.
So Antonio,
put that in the Lynch.
Antonio, Wrong your turn question two, is
coffee. Oh yeah. And is it possible for somebody, a filmmaker, to be given the chance to completely take a movie in a franchise. And,
I think that's what I said. Like, what I would like to see of remakes is like Dream Warriors, for example, is my favorite of the nightmares. So, I mean, it's because it's kids banding together to take on the monster.
And in a way, this question is kind of what Dan's working on now.
Exactly.
The Amityville has been through some horrible movies, and it's going to get that trailer is going to get a cynical response at first,
of course,
and because it's the Amityville name mixed with found footage, but. I like the idea of the Amityville concept mixed with found footage. I think it's a
one
cool
of those
idea.
That lends itself to it naturally, but like we're going to run into that.
To answer your question, though, is it possible? Yes. I mean, if the studio and the producers like the vision that's brought to them, sometimes they are open to it. But there's always, when it's a studio level, there's a lot of people involved that want to have their print on it and a say in it. So, I mean, one of the only reasons why I ever agreed to do a sequel to Hatchet was because I got complete final cut. Nobody could touch it. Nobody could do anything. It was exactly what I wanted to do.
And
I got paid a shit ton of fucking money. And so Hatchet 3, I made so much money that I'm like enslaved another human being to be the director. But still, like, we get to do what we want. So, but it's hard because you might go in with a vision and at the get-go, everybody is on the same page. But then it just sort of goes how it's going to go. And that's the price you pay for doing something that does have a big budget and is going to get a big supported release. There's other negative stuff that sometimes can come with it.
I have a question. You guys were talking about the reimagining of mythology and how sometimes they can take a franchise and start adding more backstory and take it in a different direction. But then you get things like in the Halloween franchise when they tried to bring in the whole thorn and the sacrifices, and you get the stuff.
He wrote it.
He wrote it. So ask him.
When do you run the risk of like fucking up the original?
Ask him.
No, we'll talk to Rob Zombie about fucking.
All right, I can counter your question with a question. Do you, for example, what's a remake you really dislike?
The Nightmare on Elm Street remake.
Okay, and what do you think of the original?
I like the original. The problem I had with the new one was when they went back and tried to act like he wasn't a child molester for half the movie.
Right, but my point is that you love the original, and it doesn't matter how good or how bad the remake is, you'll always love the original.
Right, but I'm talking about when someone comes in and tries to like change the direction.
Oh, I'm sorry, you meant narrative-wise.
Right,
I think it's kind of the same thing, I think it's kind of the same thing, but, the guys who make Part 3, Part 4, Part 5 want to have their own stamp on this franchise. They want to have their own signature touches. But a lot of times, like you've observed, it just kind of makes it into a freaking confusing mess.
For example, like Halloween 5, though, like we were talking about when they started getting a thorn, I can completely remember me and my high school friends had the entire first row.
What the fuck is that guy in the boots?
Yeah, exactly. And we talked about it for a year and, going, what? Who was that tall guy?
They never really pay it off.
And Dan,
I didn't cast the guy from Lethal Weapon.
Sometimes the studio will say, "Look, we don't want to."
Gained a lot of weight and shrunk.
They'll say we don't want to see the same movie again. Now, when you think about the Friday the 13th franchise, usually it's the first four that you've got everybody for, and then once you got to 5 with the twist that it wasn't Jason, and then it got off the rails.
I love 6, by the way.
They all have their merits. Except for Manhattan and Goes to Hell and some other ones. But still, it's like, but the point is, like, sometimes that's why it happens, is they say, we want something fresh, we want something new. And sometimes you didn't need something new. I would pay so much to just see a bunch of counselors go to Camp Crystal Lake, fuck, and die. It would make me so happy. But they're like, yeah, we've already done that. Like, so do it again. It's got to be. Why don't we send them to space or whatever? It happens.
Thank you.
Hey, Jason X is cool.
You're next. Oh, no, you're first.
Yes.
Okay, so your question and then one last question, I believe. This guy first, then...
Sorry, man.
He was first.
Whoever. All right, sorry.
He was first.
Yeah. I'm going to take control up in here.
You sort of look like Han Solo from here, because I can't really see.
Yeah.
It's
the best.
It's like, it's a good test.
Go ahead, sir.
I don't really degree in theater. I don't yeah.
We got 2 minutes left.
Suggestion for a remake, but sci-fi could be very scary, is Day of the Triffids.
Oh, yeah?
They are. Actually, they are. Sam Raimi's company's doing it.
Yeah, Ghost House has had that for a while.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
And hate to get back to the whole controversial BitTorrent thing and all of that. I understand how it could be incredibly deleterious for independent filmmakers and whatnot. Now, major motion pictures I have either purchased or downloaded myself. Stuff that I thought I... And knowing full well that they are primarily paid for with commercials that are smash in your face. Hey, you want to have a Pepsi? And they hold it up to the camera and whatnot. And there is a way to track how many people download and whatnot. But I'm thinking like Jumper and the new Hulk and movies I never would have gone to
see. Is there a question?
Yeah. Movies I never would have gone to see still get my eyeballs on their adverts from me downloading it. And so for the major companies, is it really all that bad? Couldn't they somehow work that into saying, downloaded it?
That was all worked in a long time ago when they figured out their budget and everything else. They still have $200 million and then the $100 million they spent on marketing to try to recoup. And if people are stealing it, I mean, it's not, there is no good scenario for it. Just like, and I know everyone hates this analogy, there's no good scenario. Would you walk into Best Buy and try to run out with a Blu-ray? Would you do that? Probably not, because you know you might get caught. The only reason people are stealing movies is because they think they can get away with it. If we can just literally, like what they did with Napster, they've singled out like 19 kids that were doing it. They strung them up on the cross, and it fucking stopped it for a little while, because once you think you might get caught, you won't do it. And it's a statement of the human condition. When those planes hit the towers on 9/11 and they fell, most people were trying to help each other, but there was a lot of people that went and they broke windows and stole TVs and they looted because they could get away with it. That's their mentality. That's what they do. And so that's the problem with BitTorrenting. Until they can figure out a way to prosecute, they're not going to stop, because they will steal because they can get away with it. And it sucks, because you're facing a moral dilemma here.
It's like somebody realized, hey, at Best Buy, they literally won't stop you for shoplifting. They won't stop you. They're not allowed. They won't even look at you. So if you walk in there and stick two DVDs in your pocket, you can get away with it. I still wouldn't do it. I wouldn't. So a lot of people would. So that's pretty much, people think because it's not physical product, you can steal it. It's not true.
Okay, someone has a mic next.
Hi. I have a title for you, name recognition, Blue Harvest. You know it?
Yes, of course.
Okay, wouldn't it be cool if someone, you know, made that movie?
Well, I think George Lucas would probably have a problem with it.
Well, I wrote the script for it.
Oh, excellent.
So will I get sued really badly by George Lucas?
No. Do you have the rights to a working
movie? I don't know.
You can't copyright, but if it's Return of the Jedi, he might have an issue.
Exactly. And I looked it up on the internet, and it looks good. It looks good. So do any of you guys want to, you know, make it? We could all...
Weinberg, you've been looking for your directorial debut.
There we go.
Send it to Weinberg.
Okay.
All right. I think you are. Okay, very last question, quickly.
For an inspiring horror director who wants to make their own stuff, like, how did you get in with
Sorry?
Sorry, I just to repeat real quick. With an inspiring horror director who wants to make their own stuff, like monster movies and slasher films, like, how did you find the way to get funding on, like, Hatchet and stuff like that, where, you know, it was your first film? I mean, obviously you had some named actors in it. Like, did you have to do a lot of networking, or?
You know, unfortunately, it would take me 20 minutes to answer that properly. However, on the DVD, we show, if you watch the special features,
I did. Sorry.
So we show how we made a mock trailer for $8 and how we got the web world excited. Now, that model won't work today. When we did it, we were one of the first to do that. So, but think about what we did, and now think of the next way to try to do that. And so, but basically, you need a package. You need to do all your homework. You need your budget. You need your artwork, your storyboards, your everything. So when you approach an investor, there's a reason to do it. But also, when I made Hatchet, I'd already written studio scripts. I'd written television scripts. I'd made a feature film. I'd made 40-something short films. So I had stuff to show. So a lot of people think, oh, I wrote a script, so now I should direct it. It's just not that easy. You got to make these people trust you, why they should invest in you, and that you can do it on a budget where you can point to other things and show the worst-case scenario of, let's just say this movie gets distribution at a smaller place that can't do theatrical or whatever. This is how you're going to recoup your money. You've got to start backwards and show them why they're not going to lose money. That's the best way to do it. But in terms of networking, this is an important thing to point out, because a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to go to this convention or this Hollywood thing and go hand out my business card to other directors. I'm going to solicit them with my script. That's not networking. Networking is calling the film commission, wherever it is you work, and saying you'd like to offer to work for free in PA on sets that are coming through, and just going there and doing a good job and making real friends that are all coming up together, and that's networking. Right. You can't just call somebody and just say, "Hi, I'm networking." Like, it doesn't work. Yeah. But a lot.
No, you laugh. What do you guys? You go on a network tonight?
No, a lot of people try that. It's
well, I do.
Speaking of networking, you know, you guys can go to get free pizza.
Free
at network.
Pizza.
Free so, pizza.
Information on the screen for free pizza starting right now.
Woohoo. Thank you for my employer.
Holliston, April 3rd.
April 3rd, Holliston. Keep an eye out for Amityville Lost Tapes. I will. Thank you guys for coming out.